Today, we join the New Hampshire Poor People's Campaign for an educational forum designed to respond to the crisis standards of care guidelines issued by Governor Sununu and DHHS Commissioner Chibonet. The guidelines as put forth would mean that New Hampshire will ration scarce critical care resources, such as ventilators and critical care beds. In the richest country in the world and the seventh richest state in the nation, rationing health care on ableist, racist, and sexist lines falls beneath our spiritual, moral, and constitutional values. WNHNFM.org now joins the New Hampshire Poor People's Campaign Educational Forum so that we can ensure our communities know the facts and are educated on the tools needed to respond.
I see all three of our panelists are here, so it's time for us to begin. So I want to thank everyone for joining us with the New Hampshire Poor People's Campaign, our educational forum tonight on healthcare rationing. My name is Reverend Jason Wells, he, him, his. I am one of the co-chairs of the New Hampshire Poor People's Campaign, and I'm also a faith leader with the New Hampshire Council of Churches. As we begin our forum tonight, I want to disclose to you all that this Zoom call will be recorded. Our friends at WNHN 94.7 FM, that radio station will be airing tonight's forum and posting a recording of it on their website for later. So we want to make sure that you all are aware that this call is being recorded. So that we can reach not only you all who are some of our familiar and devoted Poor People's Campaign supporters, but also reach a broader audience of people in the state of New Hampshire who are also interested in healthcare rationing and in learning more about the policies behind our state's crisis standards of care. So in just a moment, I'm going to ask our other co-chair, Debbie Oppermala, and our panelists to introduce themselves. But as long as we have people who are here connecting via Zoom, if you're using your device, I hope you can find your chat box at the bottom of the screen. If you would just type into that chat box, tell us your name. Maybe you would tell us your pronouns, the town that you're calling from, maybe a group that you're affiliated with that's relevant to our discussion tonight. That's a good way for us to kind of build a little bit of community and also be familiar with the chat function so that we can use that for asking questions to our panelists later on. In order to learn more about the Poor People's Campaign, especially what's happening in New Hampshire, please do look us up on Facebook and Twitter. Our handles there are New Hampshire PPC. Or you can drop us a line via email at newhampshire@poorpeoplescampaign.org and give us your contact information there, and we will add you to our regular email list. One of the Poor People's Campaign chants, one of the slogans we use all the time, is that everybody's got a right to live. And there are so many ways in which our state's crisis standards of care, the concern over healthcare rationing, touches this very central need, central claim that everyone has a right to live. And we don't want to see our healthcare standards so rationed out on classist, racist, ableist lines. And we have some wonderful panelists here who are experts, they are activists, they are knowledgeable people. So I'd like to ask for our campaign co-chair, Dr. Debbie Oppermala, would you unmute yourself and introduce yourself and tell us who the other panelists are with you tonight?
Tonight, I'm actually Dr. Debbie Oppermala. I am a medical researcher, and I've been looking very closely at COVID-19 like many of my cohorts have been doing. It concerns us about the medical rationing. And tonight our panelists are Stephanie Patrick. Could you give away Stephanie so people know who you are? She is the executive director of the Disability Rights Center, which is the legal arm in the disability community. I will say that she brought this awareness to us, and we welcome her tonight to help us understand medical rationing. Also, I would like to introduce Krista Gilbert. Give away, Krista. She is a New Hampshire State Ambassador for the Rare Action Community, an advocacy branch of the National Organization of Rare Diseases. She sits on NORD's Policy Steering Committee and belongs on the New Hampshire Rare Disease Advisory Council attached to the governor's office. And she is also a member of the New Hampshire Council on Developmental Disabilities. Tonight, one of the things that we will be sharing with you is how important a crisis standard care plan is. Without it, we are seeing rationing. I would like to share with you some statistics, and I know that I love statistics and many people don't. I'll make this brief. Hospital standard plans of care are important because we need to make sure that everyone equally is receiving services. This is from the governor's dashboard that you're looking at. And we're seeing that in this particular pandemic, the elderly are extremely impacted by COVID. What has happened in anecdotally, we have found that hospitals were not giving resources necessarily to the elderly and the disabled. So you see that 63.5% of the COVID deaths happens in the elderly range. Now the question becomes, what were the resources that were given to them by the hospitals in New Hampshire? There is no answer to that because data has not been collected around that area. So when we also look, towards ethnic, you know, racial ethnicity data, and we find that while Hispanic and Latinos population is 3.9%, they are impacted heavily because it's 2.8% of the deaths in New Hampshire. What that translates into is that for such a small majority, they are highly impacted by the deaths. It's not represented on the boards that way because when they break it out, they didn't show the number of how this is impacting overall. So when you're 3.9% of the state's population and you have 2.8%, that's almost, it's a heavy impact in that community. It's also happening here. It's overly happening. If you look down at the bottom, you'll see that it's Black Americans are 1.4% of the population, but the deaths were 2.1%, which is, again, another high impact number. So the question that can't be answered by the data is, what was the plan of care for these individuals, and why are the numbers so high? Well, Stephanie could you give us an idea of what these care plans are and are not doing?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. I work at Disability Rights Center, and so we are focused on legal advocacy for people with disabilities. We got involved in this issue pretty early on in the discussions because it became clear in working with our partners across the United States that many states who had plans actually had plans that clearly discriminated against people with disabilities, and that many states didn't have plans at all. And so, following the lead of a lot of our partners across the state, we started asking the state of New Hampshire, like, what is your plan? Do you have a plan? What are you going to do? And when we talk about plans, it's really specifically plans of how the state will address shortages of equipment and other life-saving interventions. You know, New Hampshire has been lucky so far in that we have not gotten to a place where we're looking at the lack of ICU beds, the lack of hospital beds in general, the lack of ventilators and other interventions. But, you know, that has happened in other states. There have been other places in other states where they've had not enough, or they've been, you know, at their max capacity in terms of these different stages of interventions that you could put in place for this crisis, or really any crisis where you run the risk of not having enough equipment or supplies or hospital beds or hospital services in a crisis. And so, it's in those cases, you're having to make difficult decisions about how to give out the resources that you have. And so it's really important that states have put a lot of thought into place to develop a plan for what they would do in that situation. You know, my worst nightmare is to have someone who's on the ground, a nurse or a doctor, without any kind of guidance, to have two people who are both in kind of a distressing situation, who are both experiencing respiratory distress or other medical distress, and have one ventilator that you can give. The worst idea is to have that person, without any guidance or support or plan, have to make a decision about who gets that. You know, we regularly work with healthcare professionals and try to educate them about the value of the lives of people with disabilities, because they are often undervalued. People with medical professionals, I would say, do not understand that people with disabilities live full, enriching lives. And they make judgments on that in situations across the United States every day. We see them undervaluing the value of the lives of people with disabilities. And so we wanted to get involved because we felt like states needed to thoughtfully plan how you're going to address shortages that they might consider. Deb, is that what you wanted me to cover? Do you want me to, is that a good start?
That is an excellent start, Stephanie, but I do have another question for you. Is this something that is already happening in New Hampshire? Have you heard anecdotal stories from families about being questioned about the quality of life of a person?
I have not heard that from New Hampshire, but I know that it has happened in other states. I can share in the chat whenever I'm done talking. There was an article that ProPublica just published about issues in New Orleans, which is that I'm relatively new to New Hampshire. I've been here for a couple of years. That's where I came from. And there were some horrible stories about not just the rationing of like who's going to get a ventilator, but just the kind of treatment that particularly minority populations are facing in terms of how this disease is being managed, and the push toward palliative care only, which is, you know, they're very much of a like a I'm going to comfort you as you're dying, those types of options, even when families were clearly saying, I don't want this. My family member doesn't want this. I want you to intervene in those situations. Like I'll share it in the chat in just a few minutes, and you can all take a look at it, because I think these are real situations that families are facing every day. These are the real stories. I hope that isn't happening in New Hampshire, but I honestly don't know. I mean, we try to reach out to the disability community, but I don't know that I would have heard of those stories. I hope not, but really I don't know how we can be sure of that without really strong plans that help direct and provide and put those protections in place that, you know, put in place plans where you can clearly appeal decision, healthcare decisions if you don't agree with what the medical professional is saying, and you that is clearly articulated. You're told about your rights throughout the process of being helped at a hospital, so that those you can put protections in place so that kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Thank you, Stephanie. Krista, could you share with us some of the stories that you have to share?
Thank you for the opportunity to share our story. I'll let you know, my son is 23 years old. His name is Jordan. And so just as I begin to speak about him, I'd first like to tell you that he is a relatively easygoing person who loves cats and enjoys cooking and traveling. There he is. There's a picture up on the screen, an adventure that we took. He's whitewater rafting there. We are. So, and he's part of a large online gaming community. So he has a life that is satisfying to him. Right? And he would say that he has a good quality of life. Jordan was born, and people that can see me, if you can see me, my cat is climbing on me. So Jordan was born 6 weeks prematurely following a complicated pregnancy. It has a complex medical history, including two rare disorders. Throughout his life, our family has fought, and it has been a fight to get Jordan the services that he's needed. It's been difficult to navigate the medical and educational systems. Most patients with rare disorders undergo a diagnostic odyssey, and his journey was no different. It took 8 years for the doctors to diagnose him with agenesis of the corpus callosum, which is a rare neurologic condition, and another 13 years for them to diagnose him with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a rare connective tissue disorder. So I have many memories of him growing up, and the recurrent theme that I'm going to share with you tonight is less than. In elementary school, we were told that Jordan's visual impairment was less significant than someone than a child who was completely blind. So his need was less than that person. So he didn't need a teacher for the visually impaired or an orientation and mobility specialist. In middle school, I was told that because Jordan was physically independent with his mobility and personal care, the school believed that he needed support less than someone who didn't. And if a tutor called out, they would reassign his tutor and he would be on his own for the day. In high school, Jordan was excluded from the cross-country running team after being on the middle school team for 2 years. A high school program that we were told ahead of time had no cuts. After showing up for the first practice, being told to sit on the field and to wait to be picked up while all the other athletes ran, the coach told him, kids like you don't do sports in high school, essentially telling him that he was less than everybody else. Jordan and I live together now. And I happen to be an occupational therapist by trade. I've been told that by our area agency that because of that, he needs a direct support professional less than someone whose parent doesn't have the skills or knowledge that I do. Jordan is not employed. In New Hampshire, people with disabilities are employed at a rate of 40.2% less than people without disabilities. So as I worked with our organizations to review the crisis standards of care, I was again concerned about those of us who are seen as less than because we are disabled, less than because we are poor or not white or not healthcare literate. I'm very concerned that there's no one on the committee to represent the patient perspective. There is also no one with a disability on the committee. This implies to me that the professionals and the government views us as less than, and that they believe that they know what is best for us and that we are unable to make decisions that will impact our lives. I'm concerned about the rationing of care based upon the belief that the lives of some people are worth less than others. For people like my son, assumptions are often made that his quality of life is less than other people's because of his disability and his complex medical needs. Lastly, I'm very concerned about the expectation outlined in the crisis standards of care that will increase the burden of care for families of people with disabilities and the elderly.
Thank you, Krista. Stephanie and Krista, I'm going to both ask you this question. The DRC and NORD signed the letter that was sent by the DRC to the governor and the commissioner of DHHS.
Mm-hmm.
Have they responded at all?
To my knowledge, they have not. There were 20, as I recall, there were 29 organizations that also signed on to that letter. To my knowledge, there's been no response to that letter.
Yeah, no, they haven't responded formally. I've had some informal emails back and forth with the commissioner about the next meeting of the group who actually is charged with overseeing the crisis standards of care, but I have not. We've not gotten any kind of a formal response to the letter. And it's not clear to me what the next steps are with the state in terms of finalizing a plan of care or incorporating any of the comments that we suggested.
Stephanie, could you go over the demands that were in the letter that
you would
like to see?
There were four major demands in the letter that we sent. And Krista is right. It wasn't just from the Disability Rights Center. This was a 29 disability rights organizations and racial justice organizations who signed on. And I apologize for anyone who is on the call who would have wanted to be a part of it. We would definitely welcome that participation in the future. There was a pretty short deadline to get the letter together and get the sign-ons that we were able to get. So there were four demands. The first one was increased transparency in the process, both within the process at the state level and within the process at individual hospital level. So the state is charged with overseeing the development of the state's crisis standards of care and clinical guidelines and other pieces at the state level. But as you know, these decisions are likely to be made at a hospital level. And every hospital, as far as I know, has some kind of a plan of how they're going to deal with this crisis or any kind of a crisis. Those plans are not transparent at all. We have asked the hospitals for copies of their plans and months ago and been unable to get them. We've asked the state to be the manager of these plans to make them transparent for everyone so that we can all take a look at them so that anyone who's interested can see what their hospital's plan is and that they are made available to people, easily available to people, both on the hospital websites and on the state websites. So the first one was transparency. The second one was really oversight. We asked the state to demand to take charge of this and to really look at and be accountable to the public in the state of New Hampshire that they have looked at these plans that the hospitals have put in place to make sure that they comply with the state guidelines that they've set, both in terms of clinical guidelines and the more general guidelines to protect against discrimination against people with disabilities or minority groups, people of color, or any other group that is vulnerable to that the state really actively oversees what the hospitals are doing. And not just to give them guidelines, but to actually check and make sure that they're following the guidelines that they've set. The next one was to make sure that the guidelines and plans are really friendly to families, that they're put in language that families can understand. These are complicated decisions, and there's definitely a tendency to get into very technical terms, which is probably good if you're talking to doctors, but we don't want to intimidate families or people with disabilities or the community from understanding how these decisions are going to be made so that you'll know what your rights are, how you can be involved in it, what your rights to appeal are, and to make sure that language is family friendly. And the last one was to, as Krista already referenced, to make sure that you're increasing the diversity of the groups, both of the main group who is charged with overseeing the entire process. The group is called the SDMAC, the State Disaster Medical Advisory Committee, I think is what it stands for. I'll send you the link to the webpage. You can look at all of the documents that are there. And then the groups that are more in the weeds, the one that we have been most involved with, although it's not the only group, is the one who's looking at the triage guidelines. So they're the guidelines on the ground. I can share the letter with people too. It's on the Disability Rights Center website, I believe. So I'll find it and I'll share the letter, and then I'll share the state's website. You can see where they are. They're holding the information that they are making available.
Is there something, I know that a vaccine is supposed to be making an appearance supposedly in the next couple of months. Has the state developed who is going to get that and who is not going to get that? Because that should also be within the standard care plan too.
The state has said that they need to figure that out. They had the first meeting that I am aware of on last Friday. They've charged the same group, the SDMAC, with actually helping to oversee and look at how the state makes these decisions. They seemed pretty uncertain about how that was going to happen at the meeting on Friday.
I would like to open up questions now.
Thank you, Debbie. This is Jason again. While we wait for people to write the word stack, I did get a question earlier in the chat, just simply asking, what is the current criteria on which Sununu plans to ration?
I personally do not know, and I don't think he knows. But Stephanie, have you any information about?
Well, I don't think it's really clear. You know, the state, so like I said, there's kind of two layers of this. There's the individual hospital decisions about how they would ration care. And I, despite my efforts and our efforts, I haven't seen what those plans look like. And then there's the state plan. They issued a draft plan on June, draft clinical guidelines on June 5th. And that's what when all of us came together to send the comments on that, and sent those in August. I haven't seen another guideline, and I have asked several times, like, are you going to issue another set of comments based on the feedback that you received? Are you going to issue a final plan? It's not clear to me.
Right. And that, for me, that's one of my big issues. The fact that the criteria is not clear. Looking for that information, that goes directly to the issue of transparency and the fact that there's no clear plan, and that we as consumers, healthcare consumers, can't get access to that information, and that there's not a patient on that committee providing that input and having access to that information, I think is a real issue. And it's not a singular issue about access to ventilators. It's about access to all kinds of care during this time.
Good point. Thank you. You know, one thing I would like to ask for Stephanie and Krista and Debbie as well is that without clear criteria, from the state level, it seems to me that it's up to each hospital to start to decide what its criteria will be. I through the Council of Churches that I work with, I'm in touch with a number of our hospital chaplains in the state, and hospital chaplains are frequently part of a team that guides ethics boards in making these kinds of decisions and criteria. This plan seems to remind me of the way in which the governor has treated the reopening plans for schools, and that the state took a very light touch and told school districts it's up to them to figure everything out. With a lack of criteria coming from the governor's office, does this mean that it's up to every hospital to figure out what the right thing to do is, sort of shifting the responsibility down to local hospitals, chaplains, doctors, and ethics boards? For everyone to figure it out for themselves? Is that a fair characterization?
That is a very fair characterization. I will say this. Doctors are trained to evaluate the quality of life, even when they shouldn't. And we all believe that they're trained to save, but they will at times come to families, present information on their own biases, and then expect families to make a critical decision without knowing their rights, mm-hmm. or vaguely knowing their rights.
Yeah, I mean, I think the state has put some guidelines in place. Like the state has said in their public guidelines, you cannot discriminate against people with disabilities, against people based on the color of their skin or their gender or their age. To me, the bigger concern is that it's not clear. You can make that overarching, you can make that overarching statement, but practically how the hospitals are going to apply that is not clear at all to me. And whether they have actually, because these plans can be pretty detailed and it may not even be obvious on the face that this discrimination can happen, and the lack of transparency and what that's going to look like, and the lack of the ability of letting anyone who wants to look at that and look at every hospital's plan or your closest hospital plan, like the fact you can't see those is concerning to me, because to me you have the stronger plans or plans that you've given to the public and said, look at this, this is our plan. Tell us if you feel like it's concerning the way that we've set up our structure to make these decisions. Your plan will only be stronger if you actually can ask for input and receive input from people with all different kinds of points of view as you're making these decisions.
We have David Holt on Stack. You're up next, David.
Excuse me. I wanted to ask if has there already been an allocation by the Sununu or the state of any of the federal funds to fight COVID that has been inappropriately allocated, like to, and if so, I guess how? I mean, are they going to like the Moulton Boroughs and Rise and wealthier areas of the state, or are there any issues in how things are being allocated already?
I don't know that. You know, honestly, I have not spent a lot of, I haven't really looked at how the money is being spent and whether that, you know, some of the wealthier hospitals maybe have more access to supplies or equipment. I don't know. I mean, I know that there have been some discussions about making sure that hospital plans are specific to the resources that are available. I mean, I know that in northern New Hampshire, you know, some hospitals really have very little. They don't have ICUs. They have one ventilator that they can use for someone so that they can get them to a bigger hospital, because they're very small, and they're just their capacity to maintain these interventions is small too. So there was some talk about, you know, needing to consider the fact that if you're in a very small hospital in an isolated part of the state, that what you really need is to think through how you would manage if you had people who needed a ventilator at the same time and you couldn't get them to Dartmouth or Catholic Medical Center or some of the bigger hospitals who have a much more robust ability to provide and maintain these life-saving interventions.
We have in Stack Candace Bergstrom.
Yeah. So, you know, I haven't lived in New Hampshire very long myself, and I came from a big city, Houston. And so I wondered if in New Hampshire, public hospitals anyway, are required to share data. I mean, is that public information? I don't mean about individual patients, but I just mean the record keeping about their COVID cases and that kind of thing.
I mean, all during the time of COVID, the information was being passed to the state and to the federal CDC level. That was a requirement. However, there was an intersection where the White House said that they wanted coming at the hospitals to report directly to them. And the CDC is back to getting information. So the information that is being put out is unclear at times, and the numbers are at times unverifiable. Does that answer your question?
It does. For states, I just see the same struggle with
the national lack of clarity from, you know, federal agencies that are supposed to be accountable to us.
This might sound like a silly one, but I get the need for planning for crises and all of that. And I understand the CDC had some people, and even at the federal level, we at one time had folks looking out for this particular kind of stressor to our society. Did the state have anything, you know, when you folks were looking at this, the criteria they're putting together now, the one that's in a draft mode still, was that based on anything that had been previously available in New Hampshire? Did we have a crisis kind of plan for healthcare allotments?
I don't think that the state had a crisis plan prior to COVID. I think that hospitals may have had their own, but I haven't seen them. I think this has all been put together since COVID started. And there's, if you're interested in kind of getting into the weeds of this, you should take a look at the state's website, and you can see how it's been coming together as they've tried to make this plan. I mean, I will say that, you know, Disability Rights Center has been trying to see plans since the very beginning. We've been reaching out to hospitals and to the state. It's been a struggle to get information. We had to ask for months from the middle of March, when this started to become part of the conversation in other states, through May, when the state's plan first came out. It's been all been put together in the last 6 months.
I will say this to answer your question, Dana. Before we had a pandemic and we're a slow society, we sort of thought we would never be here like this. The disability community did fight and did get a disability patients' rights that hospitals must follow. Unfortunately, unlike the patient's bill of rights that are posted, you have to know what your disability rights are. And that is something that needs to be fixed also. Kirsten, you had a question.
So what I was going to say was that my understanding was that there have been crisis plans in the past, but it was more mass casualty plans. So there really haven't been plans in the past that, like a pandemic plan or an epidemic plan. So it hasn't been this kind of a plan. So there have been plans in the past, but not as detailed. You know, it's a different kind of plan that's needed now. So there have been crisis plans in the past, just not this extensive, I guess is the word that I'm looking for.
Yes, but I would surmise then that this is a very critical item now, because if we don't put it in place now, when the next thing comes along, we'll still be in the same boat of no clarity, no transparency, no real plan.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Doris Hampton had her hand up. What's your question, Doris? Or statement?
So being new to this, So what would a plan look like from a hospital that you respect the work they've done? What would it look like?
I mean, I think that it's the common plans have to do with some kind of a score, a priority scoring system that you would use to decide who is who should be prioritized over another. The critical protections that we feel like need to be in place is that you need to only look at the person's current response to the disease that they're facing right now. So it would be like, how are they responding to COVID? And I'll give you an example that's really disability specific. So you may have a person who has like low blood pressure all the time. And so if one of your criteria that you look at is like, what is their blood pressure? If my blood pressure, because of my disability, is always very low, then my level that you judge me on needs to be on that standard low blood pressure that I always face, and not say that because I have low blood pressure and this person who is doesn't have a disability and has standard blood pressure all the time, they are their low blood pressure is less of an issue than mine is. I don't know if that makes sense. But you need to use the baseline for a person with a disability. That's their baseline, not a baseline that you expect everyone to face, because that you would be then judging them in a way that's not fair, based on their response to this specific illness and not to their general functioning.
We have Faye and John next in stack.
Yes, my question is, as I listen through this discussion, what is expected of a criteria? To me, listening to discussion, it sounds like there are two issues. One is medical viability in terms of helping a person recover, and what's the other one? Quality of life. And quality of life is quite a bit more subjective than the medical viability. And I'd like to know what the expectation is about how these decisions are being, what kind of criteria could we develop that would honor those things?
Yeah, I mean, they're never going to be easy decisions. If you're ever in a case where you have one ventilator and two people who need it, I don't think they're going to be easy. And so to me, the most important thing is that you think through what that process should be, and you make sure that any place where you could face discrimination, you've put protections in place to try to avoid that. I mean, you may get to a point where you have to pick randomly even. I mean, if you've done everything you can to protect and you determine that these people are equal in considering any kind of discrimination, you think that, then if you have two people and you have one ventilator, then that may be what it falls down to. I mean, I don't think that they're really complicated decisions. And I mean, any kind of a decision tree, which is a lot of times what they end up with. You know, you're using it. You're looking at every decision that has to be made and trying to be as impartial and fair as you can in each one of those. But I, honestly, I'm not a doctor, so I feel like I'm kind of not able to really articulate it in the way that should be done. I just know that when I want to be able to look at a plan and feel confident that at each stage of the process you're protected against any kind of discrimination in any way that you can.
Well, when you look at a plan that's made and you're looking at medical viability, some doctors can separate that from quality of life, because it's really two different conversations. And medical viability would be a question of, we can put him on the ventilator, but his heart is weak, his lungs are weak, his, you know, are not being very specific. And you have two people at the same time. And if medically viable for that other person to have it because they're in a stronger place, and the prediction is more of survival for that one, and you're leaving out what type of life they're going to have after coming off the ventilator, that means you've made your decision within that medical viability. And many times doctors are indirectly taught to bring up that quality of life because they don't want to burden the family anymore, and that is not their decision, then it falls to the family.
Yeah, and I mean, I will tell you that recently, even in New Hampshire, I've done some work with disability advocates about genetic counseling and kind of how disability is presented to families of who are pregnant, and what how that discussion goes whenever you recognize during some kind of testing that there may be you may have a child with Down syndrome that the person is pregnant with. And I've heard from more than one family that this is presented to them as like, your life is over. You know, you're going to have a child with a disability, and not presented as this is, your life is going to be different than maybe you anticipated it would be, but your life is over now. And you need to be prepared for the tragedy of what your life is going to be. And if you're having those conversations with families who are at pregnancy or who are at the beginning of this journey, then you've got it. It's all throughout the whole medical profession. I don't know, Krista or Deb, have you had those discussions with families?
I've had those discussions with my son's cardiologist, and he needs a valve replacement, and he's turning blue more often than I would like. And in his office, he saw him, his hands and his feet intermittently turn blue. And he looked at me and he says, well, what are you willing to do about it? And that is not a question that should have been asked about me. We should have been given information about what our choices needed to be. He's really not any longer our cardiologist, but this is an example of how they're trained. You know, out of curiosity, I said, what would you have done for, you know, an atypical person for your child? Oh, well, you know, you send him for the MIR and he won't, you know, he looked at my son, but he won't stay still. And I said, no, but you can give him a sedated one. Mm-hmm. And I found it interesting that they didn't do it at that hospital, but he knew where he needed to be. And he was asking us, you know, basically, do we care enough to travel for our son? That conversation should have never happened. So it's there, you know, even in normal, everyday treatment discussions, it's very much there. I see one more question for Candace, and you can come back on, Candace, and ask your question, please.
So it just seems to me that rural communities in New Hampshire are being discriminated against. And when I think about the overall state, it's a pretty rural state. Just because it's a rural hospital, why does it only have one ventilator? And I understand my sister works in a community hospital, and I understand they're set up for triage and all that, but we've had 6 months now to get ready. And I understand what's happening at the federal level because they keep up with that, but I just don't understand how individual hospitals can't get access, I guess, to. It's very complicated. So.
I mean, I think it is really complicated. And I think this is one of the reasons why it's so critical that the state is really actively overseeing what's happening at these individual hospitals. Because, you know, I mean, it may be that you actually need two or three at a hospital, or you need to have like a, just like you have the helicopters that can transport patients. Maybe we need that to transport life-saving equipment so that it's there. It's available as we need it if there's one place where there's just a significant crisis that doesn't have enough supplies or things like that to support. But I feel like, you know, one of the roles of the state in these kinds of situations is to be that organization to make sure that all of the different pieces, you know, New Hampshire is a small state, so all of the different hospitals and long-term care facilities and others, you know, area agencies and other organizations that are involved in the care of people who may face these situations are really coordinating together.
Thank you, everyone, for your questions. And now the PPC would like to share what our next steps and actions are. Jason, could you tell us what those are?
I'd be happy to, Debbie. Thank you so much. I want to give my gratitude very quickly to Stephanie Patrick from Disability Rights Center and Krista Gilbert from Rare Action Network and just name them one more time for sharing their expertise and their stories. I appreciate that last question especially because it does cut, Candace, I think, to a fundamental claim from the Poor People's Campaign that New Hampshire is among the richest states in the country, and our country, of course, is one of the wealthiest in the world. And the idea that we have a scarcity of equipment, of medical care, is a scandal. It shows that we have an economy and a healthcare system that places profits above the well-being of people. And this is a fundamental shift that we are trying to address. As Martin Luther King called it, the radical redistribution of economic and political power, that as a person of faith, I can never prioritize profits over people, but we always look to prioritize the dignity of every human being. So I want to point us toward where do we go from here? You heard earlier this evening in the talk that some of us, the Disability Rights Center, did write a letter to the governor. The Poor People's Campaign has signed that letter, and we also wrote one in our own letter in the demands of the Poor People's Campaign. So I want to thank everyone here for giving your time to this Zoom call tonight. Devoting your time to the Poor People's Campaign as we dig into these crisis standards of care. I also want to give gratitude to WNHN 94.7 FM for airing the Educational Forum. We did record this and we'll be able to make it available to you all later along with those letters that were written. So anyone who's wanting to take some next steps, people who want to organize with the New Hampshire Poor People's Campaign around this issue, writing letters is one thing, but we expected we might be ignored by the governor, and we want to take our next steps in moving forward together. So I am finding my link here to paste into the chat, and this is something that we can make available for people who are listening on the radio or watching at a later time, something you will be able to find easily on Facebook and Twitter with the handle New Hampshire PPC, or you can drop us a line at newhampshire@poorpeoplescampaign.org to get the details that I'm telling you now. We will have an action planning event next Wednesday, September 30th, same time as this call, 6:30 p.m. So next Wednesday, September 30th, if you want to help us organize our next steps to continue to bring our demands to the governor and to urge his response on this issue of moral and spiritual and constitutional proportions, we'll be gathering next week. We at the Poor People's Campaign have some ideas of how we would like to confront the governor with these demands. But we want to hear from you. We want to keep the conversation going. If you're feeling that need to be fired up, please click that link in the chat. You can sign up to RSVP for that meeting. If you're listening on the radio, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, New Hampshire PPC, or just send us an email, newhampshire@poorpeoplescampaign.org. And I'll make sure you have all the details for our meeting next Wednesday so we can start planning those steps together. As the Poor People's Campaign, we do like to take our actions together. I think Stephanie addressed it well when she urged that the crisis standards of care guidelines need to have the people who are directly affected as part of the decision-making. And we want to include everybody, as many people as we can, in the decision-making and in the making of our demands to the governor around this critical issue. Debbie, is there anything that you think that I missed here? Anything I need to highlight before we go?
No, but maybe we could give people to get them fired up about what we're thinking.
All right. I'll go ahead and do that. One thing that you may all have perhaps been doing with me over the past 6 months is that we have been watching Governor Sununu's COVID press conferences. Those happen on just about a weekly basis. And even though the governor has been unresponsive to us, we want to not just bring our demands in a letter. We want to bring our demands to him, perhaps in your car, while some of us remain socially distant outside the place where he's holding those press conferences, to bring those demands. We know the media will be there. He'll be under the spotlight because it is his press conference, and we will demand that he respond to our needs from these crisis standards of care. I think it's a pretty bold way that we could make the demands known and hold his feet to the fire on this urgent need. We'd love to have you all come with us next week as we talk more about that plan and do that nonviolent direct action together that we can organize and plan together.
Before we go, I just wanted to thank you for paying attention to this important issue. I do think it can get a little bit technical, but I think it's really important that people are speaking up and holding the state accountable and hospitals accountable to what they're doing, because when the crisis comes, it's too late to make a plan. We should have done that already. And so it's really critical that, and I'm really glad that you're paying attention to this.
Oh, thank you, Stephanie. You know, we, as the Poor People's Campaign, we realize how these things, I think as Debbie began with us tonight, that these are things that affect the disability community, but they affect people of color. They affect us across lines of class, of poverty, of wealth. When the crisis comes, it's too late. So it's time for us to stop being silent, to listen to the voices we need to, and to stand up together. One of the common chants that I'll close us out with tonight comes from the Poor People's Campaign. I like to lead the chant by saying, "Forward together."
Not one step back.
Forward together.
Not one step back.
Forward together.
Not one step back.
Thank you. I hope there are some people listening at home on WNHN saying not one step back with us. We will see you all next Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. as we start to plan our actions together. Thank you all for tonight. Thanks to our panelists. Thank you, Debbie.
Good night, everybody.